Let's talk tech with Lee Stark.
Tech Talk with Lee Stark.
Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, mate. How are you going?
I'm okay, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay.
That's good. It's a Sunday morning. Let's start with a couple of techie questions, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
Alison says, what's the best strategy for decluttering my digital life? Example, she says, is emails, apps, devices, without losing important data. What can I do?
Oh, gosh, that's a really complicated question. The most you can probably do is actually back up everything as quickly as possible and then start going through regular organization practices. So, for instance, in email, one of the better things you can do is actually set up labels. If you set up labels in things like Gmail or Outlook or things like that, it'll actually start being able to organize them. You can set up rules in email systems that automatically start categorizing where they go, so they end up being in different places. So instead of having everything land automatically in the inbox, they instead land in different locations, so you only need to check them when you check them. Your files are, again, that same sort of predicament. So what I typically do is I make sure that everything is actually sitting in the right folder. So my downloads go in my downloads, my documents go in my documents. And I know that seems really basic, but a lot of people just practice storing them in one location. Many people learn digital literacy by learning on an old school Mac, especially depending on how early you learned, or even just a Windows computer. And that meant storing files on a desktop, and that is obviously the worst place to store things because it's just not organized. So whether you're storing on the cloud or you're storing on a local drive, the best advice I can actually tell you is to actually just start practicing organization. That works quite well.
Files to junk. You could answer this question for me. Why, when emails come in, if you've been receiving an email from a particular person on a regular basis for literally years. Why all of a sudden, and the email address has not changed, your email address has not changed, why all of a sudden does the email keep going to junk?
That's usually a learned setting. It's something you can typically change by basically, again, not quite labels, but something similar by creating rules in your email system so that it sends it to the right location. So it's a learned behavior, and it's something that can actually be changed on certain email clients.
But why does it change? Like, I'll give you an example, a real example. I talk every weekend to Dr. Ross Walker, and he sends me the information, the articles that we're going to talk about, you know, during the week, all right?
Yep.
And we catch up on a Saturday morning. So I've been talking to Dr. Ross Walker for years. I mean, years and years and years and years as part of the radio show. And his email address has not changed. But all of a sudden, the emails that he sends me keep going to my junk file. Why?
Yeah. So that also can depend on how he sends out his emails as well, believe it or not. So different email systems have different rules regarding what they pick up as junk. And depending on how the email gets sent from his end, it may be incorrectly classified on your end. So a good example on that one is that if you use Gmail or you use Outlook, they all have slightly different settings that they use to try and designate whether something is junk or not. We call them mail filters, but they often happen at the server's end. It's one of those things that if you're not using something like Gmail, you're using something like an actual mail server, it's one of those talk to your tech team sort of questions, because it's one of those things they can control. We find that in the most recent times, like in the past 2 years, they've become tighter, more difficult to navigate around, largely because there's a lot of spam that's imitating the way regular people write, and as a result of that, servers tend to be a little bit tighter on what's qualified as spam. But a solution for it, I found, is those rules. If you know something is coming in, regardless of it going into junk, you can actually set a rule that says, if from this person, send to the inbox, or if from this person, put into a folder for that person. At least that way you know the rule is taking care of everything, as opposed to what the server's trying to do.
Henry says, in reference to hosting a website, has Lee got any suggestions as to where I can host a website cost effectively?
This is very much a This could be complicated depending on what you're hosting. There's a few different types. If your website is small, majority of what you tend to look at is called shared hosting, which basically means you're sharing your web space with a lot of other websites, and it's cost effective. It can cost anywhere between $3 US a month to as much as $200 a month. And so in Australia, it's typically about 10, 20 bucks a month. If your website is large, you look at these things called virtual servers or even dedicated servers, and basically they are things that you don't share. You're not sharing your space with anyone else. They get a little bit more expensive. They range between $20 a month to up to $200 for VPSs. Virtual private service and dedicated servers are a lot more expensive because they're your own machines. But it really becomes a question of how big your website is, what you plan on doing with it. It's one of those things you'd probably be best talking to someone building a website or even just looking at shared hosting online. Do a search for shared hosting. If your website is small, that's where you want to be.
Let's do some topics. We have foldable screens in foldable phones, stretchable screens. LG, a new screen. LG has been working on a prototype display that can stretch screens from 12 inches to 18 inches. What's this all about?
So this is a really interesting concept. LG works on a whole bunch of screens. A lot of people don't realize that. The screens, for instance, in most MacBooks for a long time have been LG. LG is obviously the biggest provider of OLED technology in the world. So it works on a lot of different screen technologies. And this concept is basically how they could effectively make foldables, but also I guess more flexible screens, more useful. So the idea of this one is, what if you could have a 12-inch laptop or a 12-inch computer that could actually stretch to be much larger? That's one concept we see that could be useful. But the more likely use for this sort of technology is to actually remap screens to other devices or other items. So clothing is a good example. There have been a lot of suggestions to try and make digital clothing in the future where you might have a T-shirt that changes pattern or design. It's particularly handy for brands. But more importantly, if you're going to map a screen to a car panel, this is not the first time we've seen a company try that before. A couple of years ago, BMW actually had an electronic ink-styled car. Basically, it was a prototype BMW with a whole bunch of e-ink panels like you might find in a Kindle, so you could change the pattern. It'd all be black and white, but you could change all the pattern all over your car. This is kind of that concept. What if you could make a screen that could map to any type of panel or any type of fabric that was curved, that was flexible? And so LG has created a screen that can do just that. It's still a long way off in terms of how you're going to make this thing work. But the idea is that you might be able to have a car in the future, or even a piece of clothing in the future, that changes color, that changes pattern, simply because it runs a screen.
This is one from, as a result of what you just said. Why, in certain cars, why doesn't the CarPlay app stretch to the size of the screen that you have in your car?
Yeah, that depends on the actual car's set up from the screen. Most screens are typically set to a specific size, 7 inches, often 4.3. It depends on the instructions from the actual device. It's not just you're running CarPlay as sort of like an extra feature. It also has to interact with the technology. Manufacturers are getting a lot better in this way, but basically, the logic is, over time, CarPlay's layer will likely adapt in much the same way that you've probably seen how an iPhone's app can actually also adapt different screen sizes. Weirdly, it doesn't work on tablets. You notice if you have an iPad, the iPhone app doesn't automatically resize to an iPad screen.
Correct.
You've got to, yeah, and so that's actually a part of the way Apple's development language works. You kind of have to create all the setup for it. So it's the same sort of thing with CarPlay. There's still not a huge amount of developer support on CarPlay because it's relatively limited. And in fairness, that kind of makes sense. You're not supposed to be using your car for a lot of the apps. You should be using your phone or tablet for that. So I suspect over time that will come, but it's still relatively new.
Speaking of CarPlay and all things Apple, we know for tablets, phones, computers, those sort of things, but you're saying that in a little over a year, we could see more smart devices. The rumor is that Apple is going to be jumping into the home security market. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, the rumors also that we're going to see a new version of the Apple the HomePod soon, possibly one with a screen built into it, you know, something similar to the way Amazon and Google do it with an Apple Play. Apple's security play isn't really unsurprising, largely because most of the smart security cameras out there link to a smart environment. So Google's cameras link into its ones. The Ring devices and the Blink devices are Amazon owned, so of course they link into the Amazon Echo ecosystem. It makes sense for Apple to jump into this, but also because Apple has recently launched in America Apple Intelligence. We'll get that in Australia next month. It's very close, actually. It's in beta right now, and it's largely because Australians speak a slightly different dialect to the way Americans do, so we'll see that support launched in December. But basically, with Apple Intelligence, the expectation is that when it's connected with a security system, if it monitors you, for instance, coming in up to your driveway or coming up to your door, it should be able to unlock it automatically. And that's been one of those promises of Ring sort of systems and smart locks for a long time, but it's not always perfect. It basically relies on Bluetooth signals. The same sort of thing might occur for, say, a delivery driver dropping off a package. They might be able to unlock the door so it comes in, or it might send you a message automatically to your phone, just thanks in part to how Apple Intelligence will be configured. Apple Intelligence is still really new, and it doesn't do a tremendous amount yet. As I said, Australians will get to experience it very shortly, but by 2026, which is when an Apple security camera is expected, it'll probably do a lot more.
You know what annoys me? I'm in the world of Apple, so I use Siri all the time, and I've got a remote control set up on my garage door, and you'll drive up. I've got a long driveway, a very long driveway, and you'll drive up the driveway and say, you know, Siri, open garage door. And the stupid thing comes back and says, do you want me to open your garage door? And you think, what did I just say?
Yeah, so I've actually experimented with this, and part of the problem, that's not a Siri thing so much, that's actually the developer of the garage door and the integration. And much like the CarPlay thing, that'll change. Like in one of the apps I was working on, it basically, you have to reconfirm and reorganize how you want Siri to actually respond. It's called an app intent. And so it's not always perfect. It's still very beginning. What I suspect will happen as a result of Apple Intelligence is it will get a little bit smarter in how it communicates the information. Obviously, you should only have to say it once. In fact, when you're driving up, it should automatically, if I'm honest, it should pick up on your Bluetooth signal and work out that you're getting closer and you're not there, so clearly to open the garage door up. But if I can work that out now, then surely the developers can as well.
Yeah, true. A digital detox. Now, you say that you don't need to move to a dumb phone if you want to detox. Tell us more about a digital detox and having apps on your phone that you don't want to have on your phone, or you don't want to use, or you don't want to see all the time.
Yeah, so the idea of a digital detox typically is that I'm going to switch to a dumb phone or a feature phone, something with buttons. That's typically how people do it. I've had doctors tell me that they've switched to that so they can avoid doom scrolling in life. Digital detox on regular phones, so an Android maker, HMD, they've previously made all of Nokia's devices. They've actually launched a feature for their phones that allows you to basically set up the phone so that it hides, or not hides, it actually locks apps so you can't use them. They just go black. It almost looks like something out of Black Mirror. And so you can only get a few people call you. You'll only get a few apps that you want to use. And the way to actually trigger it back is to restart your phone and your phone goes back to normal. So it's a clever approach to digital detox. iPhone users don't quite have the same thing, and in fairness, most Android people don't. This is specific to one style of Android devices. However, iPhone users can do something similar with focus mode. So focus mode is a setting that's been in there for a few generations now. It's something I use when I'm working, actually. I set up a focus mode for work that actually only allows certain people to come in, or like automatically as a phone call, and everything else is silenced. And it also allows me to set up a designated home screen that only shows the sort of apps that I would want while I'm working. You can kick these things in at certain times. With my work screen, it actually kicks in a certain GPS location, so it knows I'm automatically around it. But you can do digital detox without having to leave your phone's operating system. You just have to play around with the focus settings.
Or put your phone down. Turn it off.
Well, I mean, that's true as well, but I think if I do that, I might have a heart attack.
Talk about the AI grandma, an AI grandma designed to basically give scammers hell.
I love this. It's a stunt. I wish it was a real thing. A part of me wants to see if I can build it to see if it's real. A company in the UK, Virgin Media, actually came up with a clever use for AI, and basically they created a virtual grandmother to intentionally waste the time of scammers. The sort of thing that we do, everyone I know likes to waste the time of scammers. It seems to be the Australian pastime at the moment. It's risky for regular people to do, I'll be honest, because there are times where you might just catch yourself in the moment and get caught in a scam. Obviously, don't do that. This one is intentionally designed to keep them busy. It apparently worked. She got herself registered, or Virgin got her on a whole bunch of scam calls. And the logic was that if she could keep them busy, that was a few less people that would be, I guess, inconvenienced and fall into scams. It's not perfect. It's not a product. It's just kind of to show you that anyone can fall for it. But now I really want someone to come up with a proper AI grandmother that can waste time on phone calls. I think that would be such a clever use for AI.
Do you know, we move forward with technology, we move forward with artificial intelligence, but, you know, last week I had reason to call a couple of companies and go through their answering service, and I thought, this is just so frustrating. The process that they set up for you to actually get through to someone that you want to talk to, it just never ceases to amaze me. You know, in many ways we're moving forward so much, but in other ways we're just dumb in reference to designing things to be user-friendly.
I mean, AI, for what it's worth, is not supposed to be a replacement. It's an augment. It's supposed to assist you and make life easier. There is actually, Google actually developed something similar to what you're talking about. It developed something for Pixel that's never launched in Australia that I've seen, but launched in America, which was basically allowed you to call up services and it would kind of navigate you through the sort of hell, but instead of having to have you on the line, it would automatically set you up to call you back when you reached a real person.
Yeah,
so there are clever approaches, but they've never launched in Australia, and I suspect they weren't incredibly successful in America. But they do use AI. It's worth noting, AI is getting better. Some of the things I've been experimenting with that I'll tell everyone about in a couple of weeks show that AI is very, very clever in what it can do now, but it's not a replacement. It's an assist. It's not there to replace parts of your life. It's there to assist things. You still have to know how to do things, and unfortunately, the people who design call systems still don't know how to make them user-friendly.
Very true. Good to talk to you, mate. Thanks for your time.
Happy to help.
We'll catch up with Lee Stark next Sunday. Thanks, mate. Enjoy the rest of your day. Lee's got a website. It's pickr.com.au. If you've got any questions for Lee, send them to us via email, and we will put them to the man next Sunday.